Hi, this is Glenn Elliott, lead pastor at Pantano Christian Church. Welcome to our podcast. You're listening to a message as part of a series called Grace, Second Chance Living. God's given us an unexpected second chance. It's called grace. God gives the best to us when it's not deserved or even required. And He gives a crazy amount of grace, even though we struggle to receive it. Our culture is graceless in every way. But as broken people, God challenges us to offer grace to others. The good news is that as we embrace and give radical grace with God's help, we overcome the grace killers all around us. We want to learn to be grace dispensers, giving people a second chance.
Good morning, church. How's everybody doing? Good. This morning, I want to talk to you about two men, George Wilson and James Porter. Now, these names may not be very familiar to you in that they lived back in 1830. Well, specifically, they died back in 1830. And these two guys, they were sentenced to a crime in 1830, or sentenced to death back in 1830 for the crime of robbing the U.S. mail service and putting the life of a mail carrier in jeopardy. Now, today, that may not get you the death penalty, but I guess back in 1830, that was a pretty serious offense, robbing the mail and putting the life of the mail carrier in jeopardy. And James Porter's sentence was carried out rather quickly. He was sentenced to death by hanging, and he was hung pretty quickly after he was sentenced. But George Wilson had some friends in high places, and he actually had some friends in really high places, guys that were able to go to President Andrew Jackson and pretty much, ask for a favor on Wilson's behalf. And Jackson relented, and he said, okay, I'll grant him the pardon. And so George Wilson was pardoned of his capital crimes, which means that he didn't have to face death by hanging. And he would only have to serve 20 years in jail for his crimes. And you'd think, like, okay, that's a fantastic deal. I mean, being in jail for 20 years, not the ideal, but I don't have to die by hanging. And so when they went to George Wilson to deliver the news that the president has pardoned you, you know, this is an act of grace by the president of the United States, the highest authority in all the land has decided that you have been pardoned of your capital offenses. You only have to serve jail time and you won't be hanged. And Wilson responded, thanks, but no thanks. He turned down a presidential pardon and chose to be executed by hanging. Now, this confused the lawyers and everybody, and so it went into the court system. And in fact, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And that they didn't know what to do with this situation. Could somebody turn down a presidential pardon? And the Supreme Court's final ruling was that they said that there's nothing that you can do to force somebody to accept a presidential pardon. And so George Wilson was allowed to be executed by hanging. And he was in late 1830. Why? Why would he choose that? Why would anybody choose death by hanging over just jail time? It just doesn't make any sense. I don't think anybody in here would say, like, okay, yeah, I would much rather hang. And again, he never said why. George Wilson never made a statement, this is why I turned down the presidential pardon. Again, the president of the United States, and he said, yeah, no thanks, I'll take death. That's odd. Now, I started thinking about, well, what could be the possible reason? And maybe he felt that because his partner in crime, James Porter, died by execution, you know, I don't deserve anything different than that. You know, maybe he just kind of felt like, you know what, I'd really rather not spend the time in prison. That doesn't sound like fun. Well, let's just get it over with now. It doesn't make any sense. Maybe he felt that what he had done was so bad that he deserved death. And actually, after he was convicted, after, you know, initially he pled not guilty, but after he was convicted and sentenced, he changed his plea to guilty. And deep down inside, he says, you know what, I deserve whatever I get. And so maybe he felt that he wasn't worthy of being pardoned. I mean, I just deserve death. Now, that may not make a whole lot of sense to us. Why would somebody do something like that? And yet, I feel we do this a lot in our lives when it comes to God's grace. And that God has given us this free gift of grace, forgiveness of sins, given us this second chance in life. And a lot of times we look at God and we kind of say, you know, I don't deserve that. I've messed up in some ways that really aren't worthy of your grace, God. And I appreciate what you did for me on the cross, but I'm pretty messed up. And I think that we tend to be our own harshest critics. I know that I am. I am way harder on myself than I think anybody else in this life is. And I think a lot of us live life that way. We posted a question on Facebook this week and we asked everybody, you know, who is it harder to forgive? Somebody else or yourself? And 90% of the people that responded said, yeah, it's way harder for me to forgive myself for the things that I've done as opposed to other people. We don't show ourselves a lot of grace, even though God does. And this morning, I want to look at the story of Peter. And Peter's somebody that I think we're all pretty familiar with his life. And Peter was this guy that I believe he experienced the highest of highs with Jesus and the very lowest of lows. And even at his lowest point, you know, Peter too felt that he was beyond the grace of God. And so we're going to look at Peter's life a little bit this morning. And we're going to be in the book of John in chapter 21 in a little bit. But I just want to talk about Peter a little bit. And that when we first meet Peter, what does he do? What's his profession? He's a commercial fisherman, which automatically I've got mad respect for Peter because my father-in-law is a commercial fisherman. And I'm telling you, he busts his can day in and day out. I mean, it's not an easy job. And I don't know how much commercial fishing has changed in the last 2,000 years. But if Peter worked anywhere near close to as hard as my father-in-law works, I'm telling you, Peter was a hard worker. And he was a successful fisherman. He had a couple of boats. He had his own crew. And I'm sure that he had a pretty decent living. And yet when he encounters Jesus, and Jesus says, Peter, I want you to come follow me and I will make you a fisher of men. What does Peter do? He leaves the fishing life behind. He says, that's not for me anymore. I'm going to follow you. And in his time with the disciples and with Jesus, Peter quickly becomes, you know, the go-to guy. I mean, he is the leader amongst the disciples. People are looking to him and he experiences things that some of the other disciples don't get to experience based on his faith. You know, he gets to go to the top of a mountain with Jesus and he takes along James and John and they go to the top of this mountain. And when they're at the top of the mountain, they see the transfiguration of Jesus in like, you know, this crazy light. And all of a sudden Moses and Elijah are there and Peter's getting to experience this. And in fact, he says, Jesus, you want me to set up a couple tents? Because I could hang out here for a while. Like, this is unbelievable. And he got to experience that. One of only three of the disciples that got to experience that. Peter was the only guy that had the faith to go and walk on water. When Jesus is walking out to them and all the other disciples are freaking out, like, it's a ghost, what's going on? And Peter recognizes it. And he says, Jesus, if that's you, Lord, if it's you, tell me to come out to you. Peter, it's me. Come on and walk out. All right. And he starts walking on water. Now, he didn't walk very far because the wind kicks up and he starts freaking out and he sinks. But he had the faith to be able to step out onto the water and to start walking out to Jesus. The only one of the disciples that had that kind of faith. And then later on, as Jesus and the disciples are having a conversation and Jesus is asking them, okay, well, you know, other people, they talk about the Son of Man. And is it John the Baptist or is it Elijah or one of the prophets? You know, Peter, who do you say that I am? And Peter looks at Jesus and he says, you're the Messiah. You are the Son of the living God. And even Jesus is taken aback going, Peter, you get it. You get it. That's not something that any man told you. That was directly revealed to you by God himself. Peter, you're going to be the rock that I build my church on. Peter, you're going to receive the keys to the kingdom. And anything that you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And anything that you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And can you just imagine Peter that moment going, okay, like if you say so. Like, but just the honor that Jesus pays Peter because of Peter's faith. And Peter got to experience some highs in life that I can't even imagine. Being able to talk to Jesus and have Jesus trust him in that way. And yet, as high as Peter was in those moments, I believe that Peter also experienced the very lowest of lows. And literally the worst day that I think a human being has ever experienced. I started thinking about this children's book, and I don't know if any of you have ever read it, but it's called Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Anybody ever read that book? Show of hands. Yes. The book came like back out in 1972. I read it when I was a kid. I bought it and I read it to my boys now when they're having a bad day. And it's just about this little boy, Alexander, who's, you know, he's probably third, fourth grader. And he wakes up and he's got gum in his hair because he was chewing it when he went to bed. And he wakes up and it's in his hair. And he realizes it's going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. And as the day goes on, you know, he goes to school and his friends kind of like leave him out. And so he's bummed about that. And he opens his lunch and his mom forgot to pack packed dessert in his lunch. And so the day gets worse, and he goes to buy shoes after school, and his mom takes he and his brothers to buy shoes, and his brothers get the cool pairs, blue shoes with red stripes and red shoes with white stripes, and there's nothing left in his size except for white shoes with white stripes, the really boring ones. It's just awful. And he goes home, and there's lima beans for dinner, and then he finally gets to watch TV, and there's kissing on TV, and it's just the worst day in this little boy's life. And as bad as it got for Alexander on his terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, that's nothing. Nothing compared to what Peter went through on his terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. And it started off, ironically, when Jesus came to wash his feet. So the night before Jesus was tried and executed, he comes to the disciples and he comes to serve them. And it's the last summer, and he's going around the table, and he's derobed, and he's just got the towel around him, and he goes to wash Peter's feet. And Peter goes, "No. You, out of all people, are not washing my feet. You are the Lord." And I'm sure that Peter's thinking that you know, I've got this right. Jesus shouldn't do this for me. He is my Lord. He's not a servant. That's not who he is. No, so Jesus, you will not wash my feet. And I can just picture Jesus on his knees, like wanting to wash Peter's feet and going, "Peter, if you don't let me do this, you don't have any part of me." To which Peter goes, "Oh, okay, I get it. All right, well, then don't just wash my feet. Give me a bath. Like, give me a sponge bath. Gross." So he goes to the opposite extreme. I'm sure Jesus is just going, "Can we just stay with the feet? Can we just stay there, Peter?" And so I'd imagine that Peter is embarrassed. I mean, like, in front of all the other disciples, he's the one that looks like the schmo, and like, "Oh, shoot, I look like an idiot in front of the guys." And later on, they're having the Last Supper, and at some point, Jesus turns to the disciples, and he's got some just beyond bad news. I mean, just heartbreaking news. And he turns to them and he says, "Guys, I don't know how to tell you this, but you're all going to abandon me tonight. You're all going to leave." To which I'm sure all the disciples are going, "What is he talking about? Like, is he planning on going somewhere and we're going to go to a different place?" And I'm sure they're just wondering what's going on. And Peter says, no. Oh, no, he's got to make up for his earlier mistake. "No, even if everybody else abandons you, Jesus, I will never leave you. I will lay down my life for you." Now, if I'm one of the other disciples at that point, I'm going, "Thanks, Pete. Thanks for throwing me under the bus like that. Oh, even if everybody else leaves you, I'll still be with you. Thanks, Peter." So I'm sure that all the guys are like, "What is going on with him?" But he makes it very clear to Jesus, "I would never abandon you. I would never leave you. I'm not going anywhere, Jesus." And Jesus just looks at him and says, "Peter, not only will you not lay down your life for me, but you're going to deny me 3 times tonight." I'm sure Peter's jaw just dropped open going, "Well, I don't know who you think you are, but I know myself well enough. I'm not going anywhere." And so then Jesus invites them all to go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus knows what's coming. In a matter of hours, the Roman authorities and the Jewish leaders and Judas is coming to betray him. And he knows what's about to come. And so he's bringing his guys. He's bringing the 11 remaining disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane. "Guys, I need you to come with me. I need you to pray for me." Because Jesus knows what's coming. And they're like, "Okay, we'll pray." And specifically, he grabs Peter and James and John and says, "Guys, you guys come in with me a little bit further into the garden. Because I need you three to be praying for me right now." And it says, you know, Jesus is literally praying so hard that he's sweating blood. And he turns and they're asleep. He's just asked them to pray and they've fallen asleep. And so he wakes them up. "Guys, please, I need you to pray for me." And he goes back to praying and he turns and they've fallen asleep again. This happens 3 times. And the third time he wakes them up. He's like, "Well, they're here. So here we go." And they turn and the authorities have come. And Peter goes into like full Three Musketeers mode, pulls out a sword and does his best swashbuckling thing and cuts off the ear of a servant. And again, Jesus is like, "Peter, put that thing away. What are you doing?" And he picks up the servant's ear. His name was Malchus. And he puts Malchus's ear back on and he heals him. And I'm sure Peter's just kind of looking at him going like, "What did you want me to do? Like, they're going to take you." And as soon as Jesus is arrested, all the disciples are gone. They bolt. I imagine like a Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote cartoon, like where Roadrunner takes off and it's just that cloud of dust that is in the shape of the Roadrunner. I'd imagine that's all the disciples. They've all taken off because their Lord has been arrested and they're going like, "Oh, I don't know what to do." And so they all leave. And I'm sure that Peter is running away and in his mind he's going, "Well, wait a second. I can't just leave him." And so he grabs John and they get this plan there. "Okay, we'll follow him. We'll follow him." And they follow the mob to where the high priest is interrogating Jesus. And I'm sure Peter in his mind is just going, what is happening in there? What is going on inside? And his mind's just going a million miles an hour. What are they doing to him? What are they asking him? What is Jesus going to do? Is he going to turn them all into a pillar of salt? He could do that, right? I wonder what Jesus is going to pull off now. And he doesn't know what to do. And John's got some connections. So John is actually able to get them into the courtyard of the high priest where the interrogation is going on. And Peter finds himself around the campfire. And there's several people around it, and he's warming his hands, just trying to catch a look, and what are they doing to him? And I'm trying to listen. What are they asking of Jesus? And as he's warming his hands, there's a servant girl that looks at him and says, you're not one of his disciples too, are you? Because she recognizes John, and she knows that John's attached to Jesus and one of his disciples. So she's looking at Peter. You're not one too, are you? No, I don't know that guy. I don't know. And a little while later, a couple other people, no, you're one of his disciples. I'm pretty sure you are. I'm telling you, I don't know that guy. No, you are one of his disciples. You got that accent, like that the rest of his guys do. Like, we know that you are. I'm telling you, I don't know the man. I don't even know that guy over there. And at that moment, it records in Luke that Peter and Jesus met eyes. And I can just imagine, like, Jesus just kind of looking over. And at that moment, Peter looks at him, and just the emotion that must be going on inside of him. And realizing that I did exactly what he said I'd do. I told him that I wouldn't deny him. I told him that I would die for him. And he said I'd deny him three times. And that's what I did. And it says that Peter went outside, he leaves, and he just weeps bitterly. Just wrestling with all the emotion inside of having failed Jesus so badly. And I just that one look that they shared for a moment. And I don't think Jesus was just looking at him like, I can't believe it. Like, I'd imagine that Jesus looked at Peter in pity like, I'm so sorry that you did that. Not for my sake, but for yours, Peter. I'm so sorry that you did that. And yet Peter, is just destroying himself on the inside. I can't believe what I did. And just takes off and feels utterly worthless. Now, we're going to be in John 21 in a minute, which is one of the accounts that happens a few days later. And we know the story from here, where Jesus, you know, after Peter takes off, you know, he's interrogated by the officials and by the high priest, and they bring him to Pilate, and Pilate can't find anything wrong, but Pilate doesn't care. He's just trying to keep his job and appease the crowd. So he says, okay, you know, I wash my hands of him, do whatever. And Jesus, you know, after he's put on trial, he's beaten, he's flogged. I mean, the skin is just ripped from his body. He has to carry his own cross. You know, just the ultimate torture. He has to carry his own cross. He's nailed to it. And that afternoon, on that Friday afternoon, he dies. And I can't even imagine what Peter must have been dealing with inside then. This is my fault. I could have done something. Even though he told me to put the sword away, I could have taken those guys. And then just over the next, you know, Friday night and all day Saturday, just destroying himself. And just feel like, what have I done? This is all on me. I can't believe I did this. And just in the depths of depression. And then Sunday morning comes, and the women go to the tomb, and the stone has been rolled away, and Jesus appears to the women, and so they go back to tell the disciples that, you know, we found the tomb and it was empty. And at that point, the foot race is on. John and Peter bolt. And John records that Peter actually gets, or that John gets there first. He's faster. Apparently he's better in the 40-yard dash than Peter, but he gets there faster and stops. And Peter gets to the tomb and says, forget it. I'm going in. I got to see that he's not there. And he steps in and there's no Jesus. The body is gone. And I'm sure he's imagining like, well, what has happened now? And that night Jesus appears to them, and it says that he enters this locked room and makes himself known to the disciples. And so there's a couple occasions where Jesus comes back to them, and I can only imagine Peter then going, oh my, he's back. He's risen. Like, I don't know how this works, but he's back, and how his heart has changed, but it's only partially changed. Because something fundamentally has switched inside of Peter. And we're going to pick up the story in John 21, starting in verse 1. And we're going to see another episode where Jesus appears to the disciples, but we can see with Peter, something's happened inside of him. And he's not the same guy that he was. So John 21, verse 1. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. And it happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them, and they said, we'll go with you. And so they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. And early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. And he called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. Imagine they're not pleased after working all night long, no fish. No. And he said, well, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. And when they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. And then the disciple, whom Jesus loved, which is John, said to Peter, it is the Lord. And as soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he'd taken it off, and jumped into the water. So again, Peter being Peter, and the impetuous one, they're 100 yards offshore, decides like, I gotta see him as soon as possible, and he jumps in and starts swimming. But something's happened inside of Peter. Because he's gone back to the life of fishing. He's decided to go back to that old life. Now, I can understand Peter going back to the life of a fisherman if Jesus is still dead. If Jesus does not rise from the grave, if Jesus remains dead, then absolutely, Peter needs to go back to the only thing that he knows how to do, which is being a commercial fisherman. That's the only thing that he could do, and I would commend him, because if Jesus doesn't rise from the grave, Peter's last 3 years have been wasted. Completely wasted, because he put all of his faith in this guy who wasn't the Messiah. He thought he was, but he's not. So yeah, absolutely, go back to being a fisherman. That's what you know how to do. You were a pretty good one. Go ahead and go back to it. But Jesus did rise from the grave. And he made himself known to Peter on a couple of different occasions. And yet Peter has gone back to fishing. He's gone back to this old life. He's gone back to the life that Jesus called him out of. When he first met Jesus, Jesus said, I'm going to make you a fisher of men. And Peter left the fisherman lifestyle behind. I'm not going to be that anymore. I'm going to go do this because Jesus has called me to do it. Jesus has come back from the grave, and yet Peter has gone back to this old lifestyle of being the commercial fisherman again. Something has changed inside of him. Something has changed. And I'd imagine that Peter feels completely and utterly worthless to Jesus. And he's had the conversations inside, I can't go back to that life. I can't be the rock, Jesus. I'm just going to be Simon again. Don't call me the rock, because I am not worthy for you to build your kingdom on me. Tell you what, here's the keys to the kingdom back, because I don't deserve them. I messed up so bad that night, and in so many different ways, and I did things that I boasted about not doing. I don't deserve it. I shouldn't be in this position. I'll just go back to being a fisherman, and I'm okay with that. And it's clear that he still loves Jesus. I mean, when he finds out that it's Jesus, I mean, he goes and he dives into the water. Everybody else is like, no, it's Peter. And they're rowing back, but Peter's got to go see Jesus immediately. So his passion for Christ hasn't changed whatsoever. But what he feels about himself has changed drastically. And I think this happens to us a lot. I think that Jesus died for you and for me and for Peter. And he's got this greater calling on our lives, and there's things that he has called us to do, ways that he has gifted us, ways that he wants to use us. But so often in life, whether it's sin issues or ways that we just don't feel like we measure up to other Christians or whatever, we don't have any faith in ourselves. And we think, because I've done this, because I've done that, because I've screwed up in this way, because I'm not as good in this area, God couldn't use me. Why would he want to use somebody like me? And we start looking at our life and the mistakes that we've made and thinking that I'm disqualified from being useful for Jesus. And we think about, like, well, you know, in the Bible it says, you know, God says, I hate divorce, and I've been divorced before, and so why would God want to ever use somebody like me? I've done something that God says he hates. He wouldn't be able to use me. I don't deserve to be used. I don't know why God would want to use me. You know, I've struggled with pornography for 15 years now, and every time I tell God that I will never do it again, I'll never fall in this way again, a week later I'm doing the exact same thing. I don't deserve to be used by God. Why would he want to use just a sinful creature like me? And we come up with excuse after excuse, and we look at our life and all the things that we've done wrong and all the ways that we don't measure up, and we think to ourselves, I'm not worthy to be used. And we're overlooking the grace of God that covers over every sin and every iniquity in our lives. And Jesus sees this in Peter, and he recognizes this attitude in Peter's heart. And Jesus loves Peter desperately. And so he has this conversation. So they've had breakfast together. And in verse 15, we see how Peter is addressed by Jesus. 21:15 says, when they finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And I'm assuming when Jesus is saying that, he's referring back to when Peter said, you know, even if everybody else falls away, I'm your guy. And I think that Jesus remembers that. And he's not making fun of him or making him feel bad, but just wondering, like, Peter, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said, take care of my sheep. And the third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know all things. You know I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. Now, when Jesus is talking to Peter, it's very clear. He mentions this. He asks him three times, Peter, do you love me? Now, three, it's not that Jesus is confused. I didn't hear the last answer. He's making the clear reference to the night that Peter denied him three times. But Jesus doesn't bring this up because he wants Peter to feel guilty. Again, Jesus hasn't come to punish Peter. He hasn't come to say, like, you're right, I'm taking the keys to the kingdom back, like you tell a 16-year-old who's been irresponsible with the car. I mean, he doesn't come to berate Peter or to make him feel bad. He doesn't ask him three times because he wants Peter to feel really bad, like, yeah, I know I screwed up and I messed up. God is not vindictive that way. God does not want you to feel guilty about past mistakes. So why does he ask Peter three times, do you love me? I mean, he's referencing to the night that he denied him three times. But I think he's talking to Peter, and he doesn't need Peter to convince him. It's not like, okay, if you say it to me three times, if you tell me you love me three times and you really mean it, I'll believe you. I'll believe you. And he's not doing that. Again, this is Jesus. He knows Peter's heart. So he's not trying to make Peter feel guilty. He's not trying to be convinced himself. I think the reason that Peter's asked three times isn't for Jesus' sake, but it's for Peter. I think Jesus wants Peter to say, you know, Lord, you know that I love you. I think he wants Peter to say it three times so that Peter fully realizes that he loves Jesus. I think he's asking it because he knows it will benefit Peter to be able to say it. Lord, you know that I love you. You know all things. And I think as he's saying it, he's realizing, I really do love you. And Jesus' response each time is fantastic. You know, you love me? I want you to feed my lambs. Good, you love me? I want you to take care of my sheep. Peter, you love me? Feed my sheep. Jesus is calling Peter back into the life of being a fisher of men. He's letting Peter know, I believe in you. I want you to go back to the guy that you were. I don't want you staying stuck in this life of a commercial fisherman. That's not who I've called you to be anymore. I trust you, Peter. I want you to take care of my sheep. Because see, Jesus knows where he's going soon and that he's returning back to heaven. He knows that he's going back, and he wants Peter to be the cornerstone of his church. He wants Peter to have the keys to the kingdom. Even if Peter doesn't feel like he deserves it, Jesus wants him in that place. And he believes in Peter, even though Peter doesn't. And I think in our lives, we need to realize that God wants to use us for incredible things, despite the mistakes that we've made. Communion service, if you could prepare for us, that would be wonderful. And as I look at this story, the thing that keeps jumping out at me is, you know, God's grace is unbelievable, and it goes beyond forgiveness. A lot of times we associate God's grace with just the forgiveness of sins. And I say just the forgiveness of sins. Obviously, that is a huge thing, to be forgiven of all sins. But God's grace goes beyond forgiveness and into the second chance and the third chance and the fourth chance and the 400th chance. And that God's grace doesn't just want to forgive us of our mistakes, but he wants to use us for his kingdom and his glory and his purposes. That's what God's grace is about. Giving us a second chance to serve him and to be useful to him for his kingdom. But are we willing to accept that second chance or that third chance? Are we willing to accept that grace and to live in it? That's the challenge for us. Can we live in that grace? And we can easily buy into the lie that we're useless to God, much like Peter did. And hey, look at all the things that I've done. Why would God ever want to use me? Why would he want to use a sinful creature like me and all the mistakes that I've ever made?
Well, God's grace covers all those things. And he does want to use you. But you have to be willing to accept his grace. Peter was willing to accept God's grace, and he was given that second chance. And as we read on in the book of Acts, and as you look at in the book of Acts and the things that Peter does, they're truly incredible. And that, you know, that Jesus leaves and the Holy Spirit comes upon Peter, and Peter is able to do things that are just incredible. Again, the day of Pentecost, when he preaches and 3,000 Jews accept Jesus as Lord and are baptized. You know, one day. And later on, it talks about how God gives Peter this dream. And in this dream, it's a very clear vision that God is saying to Peter, you know, you are now to preach the gospel to all nations. It's not just for the Jew, but for the Gentile as well. And even in the dream, Peter argues like, well, you know, surely not, Lord. And it's focused more on food and eating. But the message that God is sending is, no, Peter, you need to understand, it's for everybody. Peter's the only one that received that dream. And so when he goes and tells the other disciples, they're in shock. They're like, oh my gosh, you know, praise be to God. You know, the gospel is for everybody. Because their mindset was still on God's chosen people. And now Peter has brought them this direct revelation from God that the gospel, the good news is for everyone. We're to go out into all the nations, you guys. You know, later on, Peter is arrested. And the night before his trial, he's busted out of jail. By angels. I mean, the things that he's able to do, I mean, later on in his life, he writes two of the letters that are now included in the New Testament. The things that he is able to do after his terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, the things that he accomplishes for Jesus after that day are so far greater than the things he did for God before that day. And that is the God that we serve, and that is the God that we love, and that is the God of grace, who wants to use you for incredible things despite your failures and despite your sin and despite all the mistakes and your shortcomings. God wants to use you in incredible ways, just as he used Peter. So where do you need to experience his grace? Because it covers everything. Everything that you've ever done, every mistake you've ever made, his grace covers it. His blood covers it. Where are you not claiming his grace? Where's that area of your life where you feel that you are too messed up to be used by God? That one sin that you committed 15 years ago that just haunts you. His grace covers that. That character flaw that just eats away at you on a daily basis. His grace covers that, and he wants to use you in spite of that. That is the Lord that we serve. And so whatever it is for you, whatever that thing is that you feel is holding you back, that you feel you're unworthy to be used, start living in his grace. Accept the fact that he's forgiven you for that. And it's not that he wants us just to continue in sin, like, oh, grace covers everything, so I can keep screwing up and it's fine. No, that's not the life that he's calling you to. The last thing that he says to Peter, after he says, you know, I want you to feed my sheep, the last thing in verse 19 of John 21, he says to Peter, I want you to follow me. I know that you love me. Now I want you to follow me wherever I go. It's Christ's message to you this morning. Do you love me? Will you follow me? Because I want to use you in unbelievable ways. We're going to take communion in a moment. And I keep thinking about the story of George Wilson and this guy that rejected the presidential pardon. Willingly stepped into the hangman's noose because he didn't want to accept a pardon. And Andrew Jackson, you know, the pardon for the capital offenses was nice, but he didn't pardon all of Wilson's crimes. God has pardoned you of everything. Every sin that you've ever committed, every sin that you will commit and you don't even realize right now, he's covered it all by the blood of his son. And as we take communion, we rejoice in that God's grace covers everything. Absolutely everything. And so as you take of the bread and the cup in our time of communion, you know, it's a time where you don't have to ask for forgiveness. You have been forgiven. If you have placed your faith in Jesus Christ and you've made him your Lord, he has forgiven you for everything. Absolutely everything. And so you don't ever have to ask for forgiveness again. Now, God calls us to confess. When we mess up, he wants us to confess. And as we take communion, that's a natural time to be able to confess our sins and then to thank him and to celebrate his forgiveness and what he's done for us. And that's communion, more than anything else, is a time to celebrate what Jesus has done. And Peter understood this, that it's not asking for forgiveness and asking and asking. One of the letters that he wrote in 1 Peter 3:18, Peter writes this. He says, "For Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God." Jesus' death on the cross covers everything. And we need to live in that truth. The one righteous one who died for all the unrighteous, one time for everyone's sins. And we can rejoice in that, and we can experience God's grace and freedom as he calls to use us for his kingdom and his purposes. And let us claim that this morning, that his grace covers all. Will you say that with me? That his grace covers all. Let us live in that truth. Let's pray. God, I thank you so much that your grace covers all my sins and all my mistakes, even the ones 20, 30 years from now that I don't even know I'm going to make. God, you know everything. God, and you've forgiven it all. God, thank you for your son, Christ. Thank you for what he did on the cross for us. God, thank you for loving us and asking us to follow you and to live for you. We love you so much. In Christ's name.